title of this session is God's Salvation. In the last session, we talked about the foundations of hope for 2 Isaiah. And today we want to begin to talk about what you might call the content of hope. Now, we know what gave the prophet the foundation on which to be hopeful. Now, what was the hopeful message he had to bring to those exiles in Babylon? Well, we're going to find that that hopeful message, first of all, centers around affirmations about God, because God is really the center of that content of hope. So in today's session, we're going to talk about God's salvation and God's role as redeemer or deliverer. In the next session, we're going to talk about God's creation and God as creator. And in the third session, we're going to talk about God's history and God as the Lord of history. And I wanted to give us some view ahead of those three sessions. In the final session, we'll talk about the Lord, which is a somewhat different theme. But I wanted to give us a view ahead because it's very difficult in 2 Isaiah to separate these things from one another. God's salvation, God's creation, and God's history are all part of the one God. So when we talk about them separately, we're sort of artificially dividing the prophet's message. These are all intertwined in the actual chapters of 2 Isaiah's work. So keep that in mind, that often when we look at a passage today and call attention to some of the dimensions of God's saving activity, we may find in that very passage some witness to God's creating activity, and we'll talk about those things tomorrow. Now, we start with God's salvation because first and foremost, I think 2 Isaiah is an announcer of God's salvation. This is really the centerpiece of what the prophet wants to say to the exiles about God. The prophet announces to the exiles that God had not abandoned them, but was active to deliver them. And in describing God's salvation, the prophet is going to speak about God in terms of some different attributes or qualities of God's salvation. He's going to speak of God's justice, God's power, and God's compassion. We'll take note of these things as we see images for them in the oracles. The session today is going to be divided into four different segments, and I went ahead and put a sort of an outline on the board here to assist you in seeing the skeletal framework of what we're going to be doing. We're going to look first at some of what we call salvation oracles, which announce God's salvation in more general terms. We're going to then look at the theme of the new Exodus, which is a great central image for salvation in this prophet. We're going to look at what the prophet has to say about new things and former things, and then we're going to look at the prophet's images for the new Jerusalem. Then, at the conclusion of looking at the prophet's message of God's salvation in those four categories, we'll add one more mark of the community that sings the Lord's song. Now, let's turn to chapter 41, starting with verse 8. This verse 8 through verse 13 is an example of what we call an oracle of salvation. Now, this means biblical scholars use this term not simply to indicate that the content of this is vaguely about salvation, but it's a distinct type of oracle. It has a distinct structure and form. And that structure and form is borrowed from the great work, from the worship life of Israel in an earlier period. So by choosing that form, the prophet is adding a dimension to his message. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's look at this. Let's look at this oracle from verse 8 through verse 13 as an example of salvation oracles to be found in 2 Isaiah. For those of you who might want a record of these things, two other examples that you might want to take note of are chapter 41, verses 14 to 16, and chapter 43, verses 1 to 7. These are also salvation oracles, and some of the observations we make will be true of them as well. Now, these oracles follow a definite pattern, and the pattern is important as well as the content. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corners, saying, you are my servant, I have chosen you and not cast you off. Now, all of those first two verses there are I'm going to describe this definite pattern for the whole oracle. We call that part the address. Now, the address is important. Sometimes it's very brief. This is a lengthy one. The address identifies those to whom the oracle is addressed. But most importantly, in an oracle of salvation, it often identifies those to whom the oracle is addressed by stressing the special relationship that has already existed between God and those addressed. In this case, it's Israel, of course. And this emphasizes, look at all of the words that emphasize that this is not the beginning of a relationship. This is but a new chapter in a long-standing relationship between God and Israel. My servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corners. A very elaborate address here, which stresses the history of special relationship that already exists. Then, the next part of an oracle of salvation is called the assurance. It's very brief because the assurance in an oracle of salvation consists of that short two-word statement, fear not. It's almost a command. Have no fear. Fear not. This is one of the most characteristic marks of a salvation oracle. It's important for us to realize that elsewhere in the Old Testament, this command of assurance is used to reassure those who are facing some immediate threat or danger. It's also used to reassure those who feel that they are in danger in the presence of God, you know, when God appears in one of those great confrontations. Often the first word of God or God's messenger is fear not. The reassurance in the face of the holy or in the face of some other threat or danger. It's always a word from the Lord, although it's sometimes delivered by a messenger or a prophet, sometimes perhaps even a priest. The assurance is immediately followed by a third part to this oracle called the substantiation. And this section of the salvation oracle simply supports or substantiates the assurance with reasons. Why shouldn't we fear? This is a pretty fearful situation. Fear not, for I am with you. That's a reason. That's reason enough not to fear, that God is with us. There are several phrases that occur over and over as the substantiation of assurance in these oracles. Fear not, I am with you, I am your God. Other ones, fear not, I will help you, says the Lord. Fear not, for your Redeemer is at hand. Fear not, I have redeemed you, I have called you by name, you are mine. In the face of this whole exilic situation, fear not, and the substantiation, for God is with you even in the midst of this exile. I will strengthen you by my victorious right hand, God's victorious right hand. Then, after the substantiation, the final section of a salvation oracle is called the outcome, because the final result of God's help is described in terms, and here it's described in different ways in different salvation oracles. It's described, the outcome is described as deliverance from enemies, removal of obstacles, or return from exile. All of those are outcomes much to be desired by those in exile. Here in this one it says, Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame and confounded. And it goes on really for verses 11 and 12. This is mostly an outcome in terms of deliverance from enemies. And then in verse 13, restates the assurance and the substantiation. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I will help you. Now, one of the reasons that I call our attention to this pattern is because it's not accidental that the prophet chose to use this pattern of speaking the word of salvation to Israel. He didn't just say, well, what would be a good way to organize my sermon for today and have 3 points and a conclusion? It's long been recognized that this particular pattern existed prior to the exile, and it was the pattern used by the priest in reassuring those who came to the temple to express their individual crises and laments. There's a kind of psalm called a lament in which individuals express their distress or trouble to the Lord, and the role of the priest is to announce God's assurance and God's presence with them in the midst of that crisis. Well, this is the same pattern found in those psalms of individual lament. So that just as the priest would assure the individual in distress that God had heard the appeal for help, so too now in using this form, the prophet is assuring the nation Israel in exile that they have been heard, that God is with them, that salvation can be theirs as well. Now, it's one of the things that people have often remarked on in 2nd Isaiah is that even in speaking to the nation, there's an intensely personal tone to the prophet speaking. It's not always true of some of the other prophetic oracles. When the prophets speak to the nations, it doesn't have quite the same personal ring to it as 2nd Isaiah's oracles. Part of the reason that happens in this prophet's preaching is because the prophet has chosen forms that were already used for individual reassurance. It's really remarkable how personal this message to the whole nation comes across. Several things need to be noted about the salvation oracle, and several things that are coming through to us as part of the prophet's message. One is that when the prophet announces this assurance of salvation, fear not, I am with you, the prophet announces it as something which has already come about. If you go through these oracles and look at the verbs, the prophet speaks of these things as if they have already taken place. And that's because with God, it already is assured. The Hebrew language is constructed so that it doesn't really have verb tenses in the same way ours does. It really has two main forms. It has a form which indicates action that is completed and a form which indicates action that is incompleted. And when God announces anything, it's always in the form that indicates it's completed. Because with God, it is absolutely certain and trustworthy that it will be accomplished. So the prophet speaks as if these things have already taken place. Now, I commented on the very personal style which comes through in the prophet here. There's a kind of, by choosing this particular form, even a very individual form, even though the prophet is speaking to the nation, there's a kind of an intimacy to the message. And I wanted to share with you my favorite line out of the salvation oracles, which indicates this intimacy of the message of salvation. It's in chapter 43, verse 4. One of the most remarkable prophetic utterances. Because you are precious in my eyes and honored, and I love you. Just think of the intimacy of that statement from God. The God who brings salvation in 2 Isaiah is a God of power. We're going to see some images of power in a moment. But it's a God of immediacy and intimacy and great personal care for his people. And it's extremely important to see the way the prophet brings together images of the intimate love and compassion of God with images of the power and justice of God. We sometimes separate those. It may be kind of like Larry was talking the other day about the difference between using hard and soft as adjectives to describe something. Here is the image of the God who is both powerful and compassionate, and it is the same God. Now, in the salvation oracles, one of the most common images of God is the image of God as Redeemer. And that deserves some special attention, I think, for us, because it is so central to the message of God's salvation. Over and over again in 2 Isaiah, God is described by the term Redeemer. Now, that's an extremely interesting image to be applied to God if we understand its background. The Hebrew word for Redeemer is the word Goel, G-O-E-L. It's used to describe God 17 times in 2 Isaiah, which is quite a lot for any single term. But it's used only 7 times in the entire rest of the Old Testament. So that already begins to tell us that the prophet has chosen this term very carefully as an emphasis he wants to make. It's not just accidental that he centers on that term of Redeemer. Well, the term does appear elsewhere in the Old Testament used in ways other than to refer to God. The term really comes from the realm of family law. It's a legal term, largely. The word Goel was used to describe the nearest male relative who had the responsibility to care for the family's welfare and honor in certain situations of difficulty. I'll give you some examples. You know some of these stories. The Redeemer, or the Goel, is to redeem those in the family who, because of debt or poverty, had been forced to sell land or themselves into slavery. And this was, it was the responsibility of the Goel to redeem the land or redeem the person from indentured servitude, to pay the debts, to restore wholeness to the family. This was both the legal and the traditional responsibility of the one who had the role of Goel. Usually was the oldest male relative in the family. He was to see that justice was done when a kinsman had been wronged. This differed according to the codes of law that were operative at different periods of Israel's life. But the Goel was to see that justice was done if a wrong had taken place. The Goel was also, Boaz is plays the role of the Goel, and that term is used of him in the story of Ruth, when he marries Ruth to ensure that she will not be left in widowhood and that her family will not be left without descendants to carry on the name of the family and the future of the family. So Boaz plays the role of the Goel and redeems Ruth. That's the verb used to describe his action at one point there. Now, this was all a part of the Hebrew concept of justice, which is a much larger topic that we can't explore in great detail now. But what this means is that the role of the Goel was meant to ensure that no person was to be left in situations of crisis without someone who would take action on their behalf. No one was to be abandoned in the community. And the system was structured to try to ensure that no one was ever completely alone in crisis or distress without an advocate, a redeemer. Now, when 2 Isaiah chooses the term Redeemer as often for God as he does, he is underlining the sense of kinship which God feels for the exiles. This is a family term. This is as if 2 Isaiah is saying to those in exile when he says, your Redeemer is God. He is saying that you are a part of the family of God and not left without an advocate. Indeed, your advocate is God himself. It's a powerful and yet an intimate image. Imagine in the midst of exile the power of that word to say that your Redeemer, your family advocate is God. And over again, when he refers to God as Redeemer, he then refers to God's salvation as redeeming kinds of activities. He uses some of the language that would be characteristic of family law. He says at one point in chapter 43, I gave Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia and Seba in exchange for you. That's as if paying off debts. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, is his name, the Holy One of Israel. He will take vengeance. Meaning that if there is judgment against enemies to take place, it will be God's place to do that. Now, in the role of Redeemer, God's salvation then is related to God's justice. No one, not even an exile, is left without one to seek justice and restoration to wholeness. Now, we've already, although we've been looking at some of the intimacy and the justice of God, the compassion and justice of God, this is coupled with the prophet's affirmation of the power of God. It wouldn't have been a very effective message to those in exiles to say that God is with you if they continued to believe that their God was one who had been defeated by the power of the Babylonian gods. So what? He wasn't much help in 587. Well, 2 Isaiah is quick to also say that this God of compassion and justice is also a God of power. And he does that in terms of announcing not only general messages of salvation, fear not, I am with you. That's reassuring. But he also has a very specific message of salvation in this set of circumstances. 2 Isaiah also announces God's salvation to Israel in the concrete terms of deliverance from captivity in Babylon. This is not to be your permanent fate. Your future is not cut off. God is powerful to deliver you into a new future and new possibilities which you never imagined. Now, an oracle which expresses that well is in chapter 48, verse 20. Let me read you a couple of lines here. Go forth from Babylon, flee from Chaldea. Declare this with a shout of joy, proclaim it, send it forth to the end of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob. So God's redeeming, saving activity has something to do with the change in their physical condition in captivity. Not just with God being present with them in exile, that's reassuring. But God is also active to bring them back to wholeness and his people. Chapter 43, verse 14 says, thus says the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, for your sake I will send to Babylon and break down all the bars. Can't get much more concrete than that. Now, you have to keep reminding yourself of the setting in which the prophet said these things. To the exiles, this joyous announcement, and can't you already feel the joyous quality of all of 2 Isaiah's preaching? He just always seems to be sort of overflowing. But this joyous announcement of release from mighty Babylon must have seemed pretty foolish in the middle of the exilic community on the edge of Babylon. I'm going to suggest to you a little later that maybe one of the roles of the community is a community of faith in these situations is to play the fool. Well, he must have seemed pretty foolish announcing the joyous release from Babylon when there was no evidence of that in their midst. The prophet came with no army. What was to make the exiles trust this unlikely word? Well, the prophet doesn't have an army to reinforce this image of release from Babylon, but he does have some images out of the past that are pretty powerful, because this was not Israel's first experience with bondage. Israel remembered that once they had been slaves in Egypt, that the Lord had delivered them with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And so the prophet calls on that image of the Exodus experience to give substance and power to his announcement of salvation in the present. Memory empowers hope for the future. Once again, we're going to see that dynamic over and over again in the prophet. But Exodus had already meant more to Israel than just an event back in the past moment when they left Egypt. Exodus had become a kind of an image whereby Israel saw God as constantly active in whatever situations of crisis came upon them. God, they understood through Exodus that God was active to bring deliverance, often in unexpected ways, but the essence of that Exodus understanding was that there was no moment from which there was no path into the future. And 2nd Isaiah is reminding the people of that Exodus faith, and he does that by preaching these magnificent oracles on a new Exodus. He says, have you forgotten Exodus already? Have you forgotten the meaning of that event? For every crisis into which we might come, let me tell you of the new Exodus that lies yet ahead of us. And so there are these oracles which call on all of the Exodus imagery in a new way. Look at chapter 43, verse 16. Thus says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea, a path in the mighty waters. That's the Exodus theme. Who brings forth chariot and horse, army and warrior. They lie down, they cannot rise. They are extinguished, quenched like a wick. That's the Exodus memory. But now look what the prophet says. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Now that's kind of funny when he's just called that to remembrance himself. But he's in effect saying, well, don't think that's only in the past. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. And so on. Excuse me. Well, not only does he call on the Exodus imagery, the deliverance of the sea, but he calls on the wilderness imagery, the way through the wilderness. We saw a little bit of that in the prologue the other day in chapter 40. But he develops that theme as well. Even recalling some of the specific events out of the period in the wilderness with Moses. Chapter 41, verse 17. Talks about when the poor and needy seek water and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together. The prophet is looking to a new Exodus in which the wilderness is not a barrier at all, but it flowers and becomes almost a super highway for the return of Israel to Jerusalem and to her state of wholeness. And all of these passages are announced with the characteristically unbounded joy of the prophet, because the prophet, in effect, is already celebrating God's new works of salvation. He regards them as assured, and that it's part of that joyous assurance of the prophet that lends these oracles their power. you don't tend to believe someone very much if they announce new possibilities to you in a sort of a tentative, conditional tone. You know, hope may be ours. That's not very reassuring. The prophet is so absolutely assured and so characteristically celebrative in all that he announces that it can't help but give power. The passages which show this joy and confidence more fully than any others are the ones where the prophet, you might say the prophet, almost gets carried away. Here he is in the midst of the exilic community, and he decides to go ahead and announce the departure. Now look at chapter 52. Now you understand, this is some years before they actually did depart. So you can imagine there were many people who said, there's that fool prophet over there. But look at chapter 52, verses 11 and 12. Depart, depart, go out thence, touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. This is the return of the vessels to the temple. For you shall not go out in haste. You remember in the Exodus, they went out in haste, hence the bread didn't have time to rise, and so we have unleavened bread to commemorate Passover. For you shall not go out in haste, and you shall not go in flight. For the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard. Depart, depart. Imagine, in the midst of exile, here's a prophet already announcing the departure. Well, my other favorite passage of this joyous, unbounded character of the announcement of salvation is over in chapter 55. It makes use of the Hebrew word shalom, which I want to remind you that the basic meaning of shalom, wholeness, harmony and wholeness. Well, in chapter 55, look at the final oracle of the whole of 2nd Isaiah's preaching. And look, for you shall go out in joy and be led forth in shalom. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign which shall not be cut off. Well, what a magnificent end to the book, this assured joy of impending salvation. Even the mountains shall break forth into singing, and the trees shall clap their hands. Well, 2nd Isaiah has shown us in these oracles, and we've only been able to briefly sample a few of them. I hope you will read through some of these chapters at your leisure and see how often the prophet comes back to those images of Exodus, how often the prophet comes back to those images of the flowering wilderness that will be a way for the return of the exiles to wholeness. The prophet in these few samplings can be seen to emphasize both God's intimate care and compassion for his people and God's power to do magnificent and miraculous things. God's power also appears in terms of God's power to deal with enemies. There we're going to talk about the attitude toward the nations in this in the day after tomorrow, in the session of the day after tomorrow. But God's power is also one which is capable of bringing release even from the mighty powers of the nations, particularly Babylon. We're told in chapter 42, verse 13, the Lord goes forth like a mighty man. He shouts aloud, he shows himself mighty against his foes. At several points reminds Israel that once that power of God was directed in judgment at them for opposing his will in history. So nothing can thwart the ongoing purposes of God in history. We'll talk a bit more of that when we talk about God's history. One of the major symbols of this power of God to bring deliverance is the arm of God. We're often it's a symbol of God's strength. And we're told that the arm of God, here are some of the things said about the arm of God. The arm of God brings in his kingdom. It protects Israel. It creates the heavens and the earth. It judges the peoples. It conquers the nations so that all may see his salvation. And all of these things are possible in the strength of the arm of the Lord. So, and several striking passages like chapter 51, verse 9, the prophet appeals to the arm of the Lord to awake and bring deliverance. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Chapter 51, verse 9. Well, I want to say just a word about the prophets speaking of new things and former things. The prophet asks for remembrance by using images like the Exodus images. The prophet evokes memory. But there's a danger that memory alone will simply be an exercise in nostalgia or even cynicism. Well, why doesn't God act like that anymore? So that the prophet is very concerned that when he uses these images out of Israel's past and when he evokes the memory of Israel, that it not become an end in itself. So that although he talks of the former things, he says, the former things have passed away and I am doing a new thing. Now, it's very important. Sometimes it's confusing if we were to read those passages in isolation where the prophet says, behold, the former things have passed away. I do a new thing among you. If we were to read those by themselves, we would think, well, the prophet is saying, disregard all that went before. Obviously, when we read all these images of Exodus, and tomorrow we're going to talk about images of creation, all of these things out of Israel's tradition, obviously the prophet is not saying ignore the past, ignore the memory of the tradition. The prophet is saying the memory of Israel is only important as it empowers a vision of the future. The former things show us something of God's character, but they are done, and it is the role of the community to apprehend the new thing that that same God is doing. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Why do you not perceive it? Remember when Jesus said, uttered that saying about being unable to read the signs of the times? I always think of that when I read this passage. The past has revealed God as a deliverer, but the people are not to look to the past for God's activity alone. The reason that we remember God's activity as deliverer in the past is so that we will have the eyes to see deliverance taking place in the present, and so that we will have that vision of God's future, which is coming into being in the present. God's deliverance for the exiled Israelites lies in the future. Now, the new thing which God is doing for the exiles is partly something that is like, well, it is an action of the God that has already been known to Israel, but it will be a genuinely new thing. It will be something that they had not previously known, and it's announced by the prophet so that when it comes, the people will be able to apprehend its coming. Listen to this passage, an interesting one. The former things I declared of old, they went forth from my mouth and I made them known. Then suddenly I did them and they came to pass. I declared them to you from of old. Before they came to pass, I announced them to you, lest you should say, my idol did them. My graven image and my molten image commanded them. You have heard, now see all this. From this time forth, I will make you hear new things, hidden things which you have not known. They are created now, not long ago. Before today, you have never heard of them, lest you should say, behold, I already knew them. The prophet, in announcing God's coming salvation, is saying, make no mistake, the restoring, saving events to come are the work of God and not simply the circumstances of the times. Yes.
What was that verse you just
read? Oh, that was chapter 48, verses 3 to about 7. Excuse me.
That's right. I just want to write that.
Now that's, I thank you for that. The prophet is very concerned that, and we'll see later, that he's going to point to Cyrus as a possible instrument of God's salvation. Well, that's a shocking thing. A pagan king, the instrument of God's salvation. He's saying, I want you to know that God is at work in these events so that when they come to place, you can't say, boy, we were really lucky, weren't we? God cares and is at work purposefully, and I announce it to you so that you will have the eyes to see it. God is doing a new thing. God's activity does not rest only in the past. It's the same God, but God is doing a new thing. In connection with God's doing of a new thing, the prophet not only calls on images out of Israel's past, he makes some rather bold uses of new images that we haven't really seen before. Second Isaiah is a nice mixture of both images out of Israel's past and some images that are almost unique to the prophet. The image of the servant, which we're going to spend a whole session on at the last session, is those oracles are virtually unique in the whole Old Testament. Some of the images of God's caring and compassion, his use of Redeemer, for instance. Some of his images, like the use of Redeemer, are unprecedented. They appear a few times elsewhere in the Old Testament, but largely find their substance in 2 Isaiah. Well, I want to call our attention to some particular images in connection with salvation, which call to mind the compassion and care of God, because 2 Isaiah is one of the places where we find a remarkable number of references to God in feminine imagery. God appears in 2 Isaiah sometimes as a mother. And the image of the mother as a metaphor for God's compassion and caring is a very important one to 2 Isaiah. It indicates God's deep involvement with Israel, the kind of bond that exists between a mother and a child. This is not totally unique to 2 Isaiah. We have feminine imagery for God elsewhere in the Old Testament, although the overwhelming majority of references to God are in masculine terms. But it's interesting that during this same period of time, another piece of literature which receives its final shape during the exile is the creation story in Genesis 1. And that is the creation story which in verse 27 states that both male and female are created in the image of God. It's interesting to speculate on what it was during the exilic period that called forth these images of the feminine side of God as well as the masculine side. I don't know. Anything I would say would be totally speculative. But to return to 2 Isaiah, listen to a passage like this one in chapter 42, verse 14, where God's words use the pain of childbirth as an image to describe the coming moment of deliverance. For a long time I have held my peace, I have kept still and restrained myself. Now I will cry out like a woman in labor, I will gasp and pant. One of my students said this is the earliest reference to the Lamaze method. Maybe I should have gone to that birth alternative session the other day and brought these passages out. Found, I think, though, in chapter 46, verses 3 to 4. And some of the translations are funny on this. You find translations that seem to have gone out of their way to obscure the feminine imagery of these passages. But this I'll be reading largely from the RSV, but I'll make a couple comments on the translation. Chapter 46, verses 3 and 4. Hearken to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel, who have been born by me from your birth. That verb born, to bear, is the verb used in Hebrew for the carrying of a child before birth, during gestation. Who have been born by me from, that could be translated to your birth. There's no reason to translate that from your birth. Who have been born by me to the moment of your birth, carried from the womb, even to your old age, I am the one. And to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made, that happens to also be the word used for conception in Hebrew. Interesting thought. I have made and I will bear. I will carry and will save. Well, they're remarkable images. Hebrew, by the way, all of Hebrew literature is fond of interplays of meaning. There are often double meanings and interplays of meaning between words. So this particular passage shows some of these words and how all of these meanings are probably intended by the prophet, and their interplay is part of the art of the prophets. Isn't it interesting now that the prophet, in announcing salvation, boldly reaches to the past and boldly grasps new visions for the future? A combination of new and old imagery that's really quite remarkable among the Hebrew prophets. Our time is fleeting by. In light of the time, I'm going to tell you that the prophet also has a bunch of images of the New Jerusalem. And they largely have to do with images that suggest that one of the results of God's salvation is going to be the restoration of Jerusalem. But the interesting thing about that is that in the restored Jerusalem, there's no mention either of the Davidic kingship or of the temple. This is a restored Jerusalem that centers on the community of God's people and not on the hierarchical structures which stood between the community and God, either kingship or temple. There's one mention of the temple in all of 2 Isaiah, and it comes in connection with Cyrus. And the only mention of David in all of 2 Isaiah is to say that the covenant with David has been transferred to the people. And we'll look at that in a later session. So the New Jerusalem is a Jerusalem that has as its center the restored community. I wanted to skip on over those images of salvation to give a brief moment of time to say that a third mark of the community that sings the Lord's song, which comes from our study of the salvation of God, is the quality of vision. If the church is to be able to sing the Lord's song in a strange land, then it needs to possess not only a sense of its own repentance and its own identity, its rootedness in memory and past tradition, but it must possess a vision of God's future. The church's program will only be as effective as the vision out of which it acts. Without vision, we tend really to act in our own self-interest, both as individuals and as the church. I find vision a quality that's not greatly understood in the churches. Vision is sort of uncontrollable. You know, those who have vision are usually those who are called fools in history. And the church doesn't like to play the role of fool. The more we become bogged down in institutional concerns, the less we are likely to be visionaries. But what I find happening so often in the church is that we want a vision, but we want it only if it fits into budget years, Lenten emphases, program planning structures, denominational programs. Vision isn't containable in that way. We're called upon to dream dreams that no one else is willing to dream. And issues for us, issues that don't fit into quadrennial emphases and program years and Lenten studies, we're tempted to ignore. And yet, think of what the church is really called to do. Who else but the church will dream of racial reconciliation, or the end of hunger in the world, or economic justice, or a world without war, or new patterns of relationships among the nations? Who will dream those dreams if the church doesn't? And yet not a one of those dreams will be labeled by most of the world in which we live as practical. You know, it's the visionary quality of the community of faith that has always caused the world to label us as fools. St. Paul, Martin Luther, John Wesley, Martin Luther King, a host of others all had dreams of what God's future might hold, and they were all labeled as fools by many in their own time. And there is a dimension of what it means to be the community of faith that says that we dare to dream dreams and to see visions. I use this example from my own denominational experience, and you can probably supply similar things from yours. But in the United Methodist Church, we just finished a 4-year quadrennial emphasis on world hunger. And at the end of 4 years, where we raised $6.5 million for world hunger programs and used it in some commendable ways, I feel it was a pretty good program in most respects. In April of this year, at the General Conference, which is our main legislative body, decided that we no longer needed an emphasis on hunger. We now have what we call a program on hunger, but it has no funds. It was granted no funds. Well, you know, it's as if, well, we have, hunger had its turn, now we'll do evangelism or something else. Do we think hunger has ended as a challenge to the response of the churches in the world? Of course not. One of the encouraging things about that program is that it was dealing a lot with our own lifestyle as it relates to hunger. And now there are no funds for those programs. We're going on to someone else's thing, but I have the feeling we're not going on to God's thing. This is the kind of lack of vision. You know, many of the problems we face and the challenges we face at the church are things that we will labor our entire lifetime and maybe not see a great deal of change, because it is for God's future that we work. And we have bought into the institutional heresy, it's a heresy from God's point of view, a feeling that we always have to see the results of what we do, a feeling that effectiveness is the only measure of the activity of God in the world. There were those who labored for causes for an entire lifetime that never saw any of the fruits of those labors, and later generations reaped the benefits of their faithfulness. Read the stories of some of the early abolitionists, for instance. Well, I want to close by just saying something about, let me make 3 quick points about what it means to be a visionary community. The first of those points is that the visionary community, like Second Isaiah, dares to proclaim salvation. Now, that may seem obvious, but let me tell you, there are many who have decided that wholeness is not possible any longer. And so their response is to get what they can for themselves while they can get it. The church, if it is a visionary community, will be those who proclaim that there are no hopeless situations. As complex and difficult as all the problems of our age seem, in the community of the vision of God's salvation, there are no hopeless situations. And our task then is to proclaim, in proclaiming salvation, is to align ourselves with God's justice and power and compassion where we see it at work in the world, in hope that through God all things are possible. In the days ahead, we might ask ourselves, where are those forces of God's salvation at work? Where might we work for them? Where do we see God's new thing emerging? Those are the important questions for the visionary community. A second quality of the visionary community is the ability to believe that things will happen
concretely. They live, therefore, only for the moment, hoping that the future doesn't catch up with them. Douglas John Hall has an image in his book, Light in Our Darkness, where he says that North American life reminds him of that moment on the schoolyard just after the recess bell has rung. But you all know that on the schoolyard, when the recess, when the bell rings, ending recess, the students don't all rush to line up to go in. There's a sudden burst of frenzied activity to get in all of the last play that can possibly be gotten in before someone really gets them to line up to file back into the schoolhouse. And he says, North American life reminds him of the moment after the bell has rung. We all know this pattern of life can't go on, but we're in that frenzied burst of activity to get all of the last bit for oneself in that we can. And that essentially is a lifestyle of hopelessness. I want to tell you, that's a lifestyle of hopelessness because it doesn't see any faithful life beyond that moment. It sees no possibilities for the future. And finally, I just want to end by saying that the visionary community that lives for the future has a life characterized by joy. And we've already seen that joy in 2 Isaiah. But those who work for the churches in the terms of the church's response to the great issues of our time, who appear only as gloom and doom purveyors and have no sense of celebration of the future toward which we are working, are not serving the community of faith. The joyous quality of 2 Isaiah's oracles is remarkable when we remember the setting of exile in which they were preached. And joy is the byproduct of vision in the church. Without that vision, we will not be able to celebrate when the full fruition of God's kingdom, which we celebrate, lies yet in the future. Those who see that vision can celebrate, can dance the dance now with fulfillment yet to come.